This podcast is brought to you by the Queer Avengers and PrideNZ.com.
Okay, good morning everybody. I'm sorry for the slight delay, but we'll get things underway now. This morning we have Ian Anderson. Ian is a queer Pākehā student active in socialist politics. Ali is also going to speak to us, third-generation settler colonist in Palestine, anarcho-feminist and Palestine solidarity activist. And MZ is going to speak as well, although not originally on this panel. It's great that she's able to speak with us this morning. She's a member of Shakti, a feminist organisation working to end family violence in Asian, Middle Eastern and African communities in Aotearoa and Australia. And we have another speaker who will be hopefully arriving shortly, who is Nadia, who's a teacher in active Palestine solidarity work. I'll hand over to Ian to get things underway.
Cool, thanks. So this session we're going to be talking about imperialism, nationalism and queer liberation. And I'll just give a sort of warning beforehand that there'll be some discussion of torture and sexual violence, so you know that's just people know. And okay, so I'll start with something that was one of the initial reasons why we wanted to have this discussion, and I'm not against the people who participated in this particular action. I participated. I get where it's coming from. But I think it shows some of the problems with where queer politics are at right now in a lot of the kind of imperialist world. So this was a call for a rally in solidarity with people in Russia and globally against queer oppression. It said, citizens will march and rally in cities across the globe. Rio, London, Berlin, New York, Sydney and more, standing up against inequality and discrimination. The time has come where we send a message to countries like Russia, Uganda, Iran, and every homo/trans oppressive nation that all humans are created equal and deserve freedom. We must take a stand. So what do people get out of that? Is there any issues people can see with that?
Yeah. It implies that countries like the UK and Australia and America aren't homo and trans oppressive nations?
Yeah, exactly. So, for example, in a country where trans women are 20 times more likely to be imprisoned than other people, those nations aren't trans oppressive. So it's like there's a set of nations which are not homo and trans oppressive and a set of nations that are.
Also incredible. All humans are created equal and deserve freedom. All of those countries on that top line are either colonizers or settler states, states.
Yeah.
So we have this weird thing where there's some kind of conflict being talked about.
Definitely. So, and on the one side you have all humans are created equal, which is obviously from all men are created equal, so it's drawing from the US Constitution. It's tying in, so this is kind of tying in queer liberation in theory with the United States in particular, and with allegiance with the United States. And so it sets up this two-sided kind of binary thing, equality, freedom on one side, and also a minority world, imperialist nations on one side, and then homo and trans oppressive, inequality and discrimination, and majority world nations on the other side, or at least nations not aligned with the US in a lot of cases, so Russia, for example. This kind of is like the idea of the West versus the rest is kind of one of the ways you could kind of frame that. What are some other differences? One difference we could see if the binary here is kind of US and Russia, which obviously Russia was kind of the great evil for US imperialism for a long time. Well, one comparison you could make is that the first US state legalized sodomy in 1962, and it was legalized nationwide in 2003, whereas the first legalization of homosexuality in Russia, which was arguably the first legalization after setting up the kind of legal infrastructure that policed homosexuality in Europe, was in 1917. So this isn't to say that Russia has necessarily a better record than the US at all. It's to say that the way we understand these differences are like ideological, and the fact that it's considered normal that the US definitely has a better record and the rest of the world definitely has a worse record is obviously a distortion. So this is Orientalism. So it's kind of the idea of the West against the rest, which, you know, Edward Said talked about this, that the basic distinction between the East and the West is the starting point for elaborating theories concerning the Orient. And the Orient obviously is kind of a construction here, and it conflates a lot of different situations into one. And he says the whole point is not that it's a misrepresentation of some Oriental essence, which he doesn't for a moment believe, but that it operates as representations usually do for a purpose, according to a tendency in a specific historical, intellectual, and even economic setting. So, in other words, these devices are being used to justify a certain kind of domination. It's not necessarily that they're accurate or inaccurate, but that they're being used in a certain way to serve a certain kind of power. So how did we get to this kind of division of the world? Because it hasn't always existed, and it won't always exist. So Leslie Feinberg argues in Transgender Warriors that if human history were compressed into a year, 360 days would consist of communal societies with normalised gender and sexual diversity. So, for example, Fafafene in Samoa is an example of this. Or, you know, Takatapui in Aotearoa, you know, there's a huge range of gender and sexual diversity throughout human history, and that only the last 5 days of human history would consist of class societies with a sort of punitively policed gender binary and a punitively policed family structure. So again, how did we get here? And this is, again, it's compressing thousands of years of history in Feinberg's terms into 5 days and here into a few minutes. So it's going to be simplistic. This is looking specifically at the history that happened in Europe, because Europe was then the exporter of a particular model of gender and sexuality worldwide, through colonization. So you had the emergence of class society, the emergence of, you know, a surplus, people could rely on the labour of others, in order to protect this private property and protect patriarchal inheritance, you saw the enforcement of this new strict gender binary. So in early sort of early on in the sort of Judeo-Christian tradition, and you know, in Deuteronomy, and you first started to see, you know, prohibition of eunuchs, saying, you know, there will be no people who are wounded in the stones cannot be in the kingdom of the Lord. And this was like to do with policing previously existing pagan traditions, various traditions of gender and sexual diversity. To protect this new patriarchal private property system. So there was a global expansion from here, so the expansion to the Americas, which began to impose the gender binary, and the struggle against this colonization was also a struggle for these forms of society which had more gender and sexual diversity. So, for example, later on, when you had Crazy Horse resisting colonization, Crazy Horse had names granted to him, Two Spirit names granted to him, and had relationships with Two Spirit people. So, whereas the colonial authorities worldwide were trying to enforce this kind of strict new gender system. So, for example, here in this country, there was a worry that men in the colonies were having sex with each other too much, so they had to bring more women over so that they could set up nuclear families. So this was a very deliberate strategy of enforcing this new system. But I'm kind of skipping ahead of myself there, because then from the emergence of feudalism, you had the capitalist revolutions in the Americas and in France, which kind of created a new kind of a gender binary, a new gender division of labour. So you had the division between particularly unpaid women's work and paid men's work. And with that, from colonisation, the establishment of global imperialism, so that's economic, military and cultural dominance of a global majority by a global minority. And all that time you've had resistance movements, so there were the European peasants' movements, used cross-dressing as a form of resistance. Feinberg claims Joan of Arc as a transgender warrior because they were sentenced not strictly speaking for resisting like the dominance of the church militarily, but for cross-dressing. And there were also folk heroes like Rebecca and her daughters who cross-dressed when they were smashing toll gates, among other things. So there was a form of peasant resistance in Europe. Also in struggles against colonisation, so I mentioned Crazy Horse, who had, who, you know, as well as struggling for land and all that, was struggling for the protection of a culture which was more diverse in terms of gender and sexuality. And through new workers' movements, you saw new struggles for gender and sexual liberation. So you saw in the late 19th, early 20th century. Struggles that that culminated, for example, in the Russian Revolution, which I previously mentioned, which saw the legalization of something which had been prohibited only in the last few centuries, only relatively recently, you could say, and then urban struggles. So you had gender non-conforming folk clashing with police in the new sort of urban settings. And out of all this, and this sort of particular set of historical contradictions, you saw the emergence of a politics of gay visibility. So there were sort of, for a long time, before what we now know as gay visibility, but only really in the last century and a half maybe, you had the establishment of men's sort of homosexual organisations. So they were kind of fairly... you could say fairly conservative. So there was the Homosexual Law Reform Society in the UK, the Matterton Society in the US, the Dorian Society here. And those predated Stonewall. They won some legal reforms. And at the same time, you had the street-level struggles that were happening, which also predated Stonewall. And then in Stonewall riots in 1969, in the imperialist world, you saw the emergence of the Gay Liberation Front. So this was in New York, in the US, in the context of much bigger struggles. You saw riots where basically people took on police, and so people like Sylvia Rivera, who were involved in other struggles at the time, were at the forefront of that. And out of that, there was a politics of gay visibility, so people marching on the streets saying, we're here, that kind of thing. And that momentarily kind of merged a number of struggles, but they quickly broke apart again. So in the early 70s, there was a split between the trans groups and the gay groups. So from the Gay Liberation Front group, you had then Street Trans Action Revolutionaries, which was Sylvia Rivera's group, and the more sort of gay rights groups like the Human Rights Campaign. And so over the following decades, the new gay movement won some legal reforms, so removal from the DSM, no longer being a mental illness. You saw legalization, you saw civil unions, now marriage. In the US, the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell quite recently. So now in this context... This gay movement that's won these struggles, you see what gets termed homonormativity. This is by sort of discourse theorists relatively recently, homonormativity and homonationalism. So in the post-Cold War US kind of emerged as the only credible ideological option, the arbiter of feminism and freedom struggles, and queer identity is... Queerness is kind of contingent or sort of reliant on these wider structures of power. So we can't understand queerness without understanding its relationship to these wider structures of power. So to simplify homonormativity, it could be sort of an idea that benefits, or a form of struggle that most benefits kind of white, monogamous people who want to marry a member of the same sex and have children, which isn't necessarily anything against those people, but it's leaving everyone else behind. And then there's homo nationalism, which is kind of queerness that is contingent or reliant on structures of imperialist nationalism. So we can see Lady Gaga here, where it's kind of this queerness. She's in front of a US flag talking about don't ask, don't tell, talking about how our boys on the front line should be able to live out of the closet. So it's this queerness that's validated through going out and killing people in Afghanistan and Iraq. So Jasbir Poir, this is obviously part of how the cultural dominance of imperialism is justified, says the ascendancy of whiteness does not require heterosexuality so much as it requires heteronormativity, or its mimicry in the form of hononormativity. So part of the cultural dominance of imperialism is justified through these gender and sexual systems. So Abu Ghraib, which is an example Jasbir Poir goes into a bit, and this is obviously what I was warning about. So if people aren't comfortable with this, you know, let me know, kind of thing. But or leave, or yeah, anyway. So so this, in terms of Abu Ghraib, which was I'm sure people are aware, is a case where a number of photos of people being tortured were released. There's an aspect of that was that this narrative of cultural difference was used to plan these methods of torture. So there was kind of this whole thing of, well, in a lot of discussions of torture, in US documents, there was a discussion that, well, Arab men and Muslim men are not comfortable with homosexuality, so we need to force them into these situations in order to torture them. And then to criticise the torture, people were saying, well, you know, people, they're not respecting cultural difference, you know, they're not respecting that Arab men and Muslim men aren't comfortable with these forms of sexuality. Not that, you know, that a Western person, like, you know, would be obviously perfectly comfortable with being tortured and forced to do things against their will, to do sexual things against their will, as if it was the Arab men's homophobia that was the torture and not the actual not the actual violation of consent and the methods of torture. So Jasbir Poir says, given the unbridled homophobia, among other phobias demonstrated by the US guards, it is ironic yet predictable that the US emerges as sexually exceptional. Less homophobic and more tolerant of homosexuality, and less tainted by misogyny and fundamentalism than the repressed, modest, nudity-shy Middle East. So even now, with this clearly, like, violent and sexually violent form of sort of imperialism, still, as Jasbir Poir says, the Orient symbolises the space of repression and perversion, and the site of freedom has been relocated to Western identity. And at the same time, imperialist violence against women is normalised because it's not considered exceptional that women are raped during wartime. It's considered exceptional that men are forced to do sexual things against their will during wartime. So you had Mubarak Dahir, who is a gay man of Arab descent, talks about how there's this claim by people in the gay and lesbian community that the invasion and occupation of Iraq is not a gay issue. And he says that it crumbled here because as a gay man and a person of Arab descent, he felt a double sting, and he was wondering essentially, was the problem that they were was it considered more despicable that they were performing gay sex or that they were Arabs, and that this was that being considered a form of and so he said that these are essentially the same issues for me. Okay, and so more recently, I think an example of how homo nationalism has played out, which is bringing us back to the initial kind of discussion I started from, is the recent stuff around Russia, where I think Russia and Eastern Europe generally, depending on circumstances and depending on power, can be cast as kind of white or as Oriental, depending on what purpose and what sort of power is being served. So, for example, during the Cold War, Russia was kind of the Bolsheviks were cast as as Jewish, long eyebrows, kind of Eastern Oriental caricatures. So depending on what purpose is being served, they can be cast as white or Oriental. And I think the way a lot of the Russia stuff has been cast has been quite Orientalist. So you've seen, obviously recently there's been a re-entrenchment of homophobia. It's part of a sort of nation-building project. It also involves attacks on ethnic minorities. And it's because of an economic insecurity that these groups are being scapegoated. And so LGBT groups in Russia have advised against boycotts, advised against the Olympics boycott, for example, and whereas a lot of prominent gay men and gay groups have called for boycotts, called for particularly boycotting the Olympics, moving it to Vancouver, which is which is colonised land, and the previous Olympics in Vancouver, there were boycott struggles because of that. And whereas the LGBT groups in Russia argue for a politics of visibility, the Western groups aren't really paying attention and have even called for boycotts on supposedly Russian vodka, which actually isn't produced in Russia. So actually not paying attention to the situation and just kind of thinking they can go ahead and do this for other people. So what does this mean for a politics of global queer equality, which is... That was the slogan that was used for this action in Civic Square in solidarity with Russia, and it's a slogan that I like. I like the idea of it, but what would it mean? What would a politics of global queer equality look like? I think partly it means paying attention to the voices of gender minorities in the majority world, and in general paying attention to the voices of people you are solid with and not trying to act for people. It means struggles for gender and sexual liberation must also mean struggles for cultural and economic liberation, and those things can't be entirely divorced. And there's a couple of quotes which I think describe what I see this as, which are nobody's free until everybody's free. So instead of this idea of people in the West as free and other people as unfree, that nobody's free until everybody's free. And also a quote from Karl Liebknecht, who is a communist who opposed World War I, when many of the socialists of the time were supporting World War I, said, or the reformists, he said, the main enemy is at home. So for us, I think, for particularly white people in the imperialist world, the main enemy is at home. That's me, and we'll move on. Yeah. Cool.
Great, thank you.
Yeah, so I'm specifically talking about pinkwashing, but I kind of wanted to start by fleshing out some of the things that Ian introduced. So like Ian said, by homonormative we mean a normative way of being gay. That's the idea that the proper gay person is someone who's cisgendered, monogamous, white, middle class, got lots of those pink dollars. Definitely not disabled, because disabled people aren't even supposed to have a sexuality. And for normative gay, someone who just wants to be equal, just wants to be able to serve their country in the military, to get a job and get married and have babies and fit into heteronormative society. So this is the person who's really non-threatening, because they don't want to destroy marriage or the nuclear family or any of those really important institutions, and they're just like you and they should have equality. Homo nationalism stands for homo normative nationalism, and it's about the way that the cause of LGBT rights, but actually usually just G and L rights, gets used to prop up nationalism and to justify imperialism and militarism. So, for example, when people use arguments about Arab culture being homophobic or Muslim culture being homophobic to justify imperialist wars on countries like Iran or Afghanistan or Iraq, or in on a more local level, I think we saw a lot of that in the kind of media discussion around the Marriage Equality Act, where it was like, oh, the problem is Pacific Islanders, the culture is conservative and they're really religious and patriarchal, unlike these nice white people that totally support equality. And I think it's worth thinking about the kind of correlation that exists between the social acceptance of some queers, of normative gays, and the rise of particularly anti-Arab and anti-Muslim racism, because identity is always defined in opposition to someone, and it's like this one oppressed group or a section of it has been allowed into the fold of proper society, of normative society, at the expense of someone else, which, like Ian was saying, is about emphasizing this dichotomy between the white West, which is modern and progressive and liberal, and the brown East, you know, Arabs and Muslims, Southeast Indians, and other populations that are constructed as conservative and patriarchal and homophobic and violent and backwards and dangerous terrorists. Pinkwashing is specifically about the way that GLBT rights are used as a marketing strategy to whitewash over unethical behaviour. So we see that in the corporate world, where we have these kind of gay-friendly, pink-dollar marketing campaigns that are used to distract us from the way that corporations treat their workers. And we also see it, for example, when the New Zealand Defence Force wins an award for being really inclusive of LGBT personnel, which is a nice way of distracting us from the fact that the strategic interests that the New Zealand Defence Force is protecting usually aren't the interests of the people who actually live in the countries that are being invaded. For the purpose of this talk, I'm going to specifically concentrate on Israel as an example of pinkwashing. And that is mostly because I'm Israeli, or more accurately, I'm a settler colonist on Palestinian land. I'm not 100% sure how familiar you guys all are with the situation in Palestine at the moment, so I'm going to summarize it really quickly. So the yellow bits on the map are the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, collectively known as the Occupied Palestinian Territories. In Gaza, Palestinians are living under siege. In the West Bank, they live under military occupation. The blue bits are the 1948 territory, which is more commonly known as Israel, and Palestinian citizens of Israel are subject to a whole lot of legal and institutional discrimination, as well as discrimination on a personal level. So just one example, we have a hotline in Israel that people can phone to report Jewish women who are dating Palestinian men. Meanwhile, there are 7 million Palestinian refugees who live in exile. It's the biggest refugee population in the world, and most of them live in refugee camps in neighboring countries. So that's entire generations of people who've lived their whole lives in refugee camps. So essentially what we have here is an apartheid state. And maintaining an apartheid state requires you to do a whole lot of public relations work to convince the rest of the world that actually you were a beacon of human rights and democracy and a light onto the nations and not an apartheid state at all. And that's where Brand Israel comes in. Brand Israel is part of this marketing campaign that the Israeli state has created, which part of it is to promote Israel as a gay-friendly country. And really, this is a two-pronged approach. On the one hand, promoting Israel as this modern, democratic, liberal country where women have equality and queer people have equality, And at the same time, it's about constructing Arabs and Muslims in general, but specifically Palestinians, as conservative and patriarchal and homophobic and violent. So it's, again, about that dichotomy of them and us. It's about situating Israel as part of the West and like the West, and situating Palestinians as part of the scary terrorist East. So that's exactly the kind of Orientalism that Ian was talking about. For example, I don't know if any of you have seen this image before it was circulated on the internet. Does anyone know the history of either of the pictures here? Okay, so first of all, the image on the right is a little bit misleading. The two soldiers in the photo aren't actually lovers, and one of them is heterosexual. The photo was staged by the Israeli Defense Force spokesperson's office. They got two of the soldiers in the service to pose for this photo, and they posted it on their Facebook page with the caption, "It's Pride Month. Did you know that the IDF treats all of its soldiers equally? Let's see how many shares you can get for this photo." It was quite an embarrassment for them when it was later revealed that the entire thing was staged. Meanwhile, the image on the left is completely incorrect. This photo isn't from Palestine, it's from Iran, and it was circulated a lot in the Western media, I guess in the early 2000s. The two boys in the photo were hanged by the Iranian state. The reason is unclear. Originally, Western media outlets were reporting that they were hanged for having consensual sex with each other. But human rights NGOs didn't find any evidence that corroborates that, and later it emerged that it's more likely that they were hanged for raping a younger boy. Either way, it's horrific. You know, the death penalty is never okay, especially when it's used against children. But this is an example of a way that information about human rights violations gets manipulated in order to justify imperialist intentions, whether it's against Palestinians or against Iran. Part of the Brand Israel campaign has been about promoting Israel as a gay tourism destination, and I guess it's kind of a double win, because on the one hand it's a propaganda win for the state, it's also good for the economy. Again, it's about this idea of pink dollars that apparently all gays have millions of to spend. So these guys, Vincent and Bruno, are the first gay French couple to get married after France legalized same-sex marriage earlier this year. The CEO of Tel Aviv Global and Tourism, Hila Oren, came up with this amazing marketing idea where she invited this couple to come and honeymoon in Tel Aviv during Tel Aviv Pride Week. So you actually have to congratulate her. It's a great PR plan. And she knew it. You know, she told the Times of Israel, "The meaning beneath our mission is to broaden the conversation about Tel Aviv, for people to know that Tel Aviv is a place of tolerance, of business and tourism, a place beyond the conflict." No, a place beyond the conflict that is built on the ruins of ethnically cleansed villages, but nevertheless a place beyond the conflict. Vincent told Israeli media that, "For us, it's very important to be a bridge, especially here in the Middle East, so that what's happened in France and the way we are received and embraced here can become an example for the rest of the Middle East." So there you have it again. Imperialist countries like Israel and France as this beacon of enlightenment that will teach those backwards Middle East people how you should be more tolerant. This kind of pinkwashing has found its way to New Zealand as well. Does anyone remember this placard?
Yeah.
Yeah, so at Queer of the Night 2011, someone showed up with this pro-Israel placard. So here we have an event which lots of people here put heaps of work into organising, but was supposed to be about standing up against oppression, specifically transphobia and homophobia, And somehow somebody managed to derail it and use it as an opportunity to incite discrimination and prejudice against Arab and Muslim people. Of course, sometimes pinkwashing is a lot subtler than that. I read this in Express a few months ago. It's about, well, it's an opinion piece on how Auckland should have a pride centre, but as an example, they use the gay cultural centre in Tel Aviv, which I don't know if you can see it very clearly in that photo. It's got a couple of small rainbow flags and this ginormous Israeli flag, which is like, you know, as long as this room and covers the entire building. And, you know, I don't blame the guy who wrote this article for being impressed with Tel Aviv having a gay cultural centre, because Tel Aviv is a really cool city, it's got a cool queer scene, and it probably seems really innocuous on the surface. But talking about how great Tel Aviv is for queers while ignoring the wider context of racism and ethnic cleansing is exactly how pinkwashing works. And Sarah Schulman, who's a Jewish-American lesbian writer, put it really well when she said, Tel Aviv is a theatre set. Behind it is the reality of profound oppression and violation of human rights. And here's the thing that a lot of people miss when we talk about pinkwashing and when they use pinkwashing arguments. Transphobia and homophobia aren't limited to Arab and Muslim societies. Israel is an incredibly homophobic and transphobic society. New Zealand has its own problems with anti-queer oppression, which we're all way too aware of. And more than that, I think people tend to see struggles against transphobia and homophobia and sexism as separate from struggles against racism and colonization. And they really, really aren't. They can't be fought separately. They're too intertwined. And in Palestine in particular, they're all part of the same matrix of violence and oppression. And that's not, that comes through in really practical ways. For example, if the Israeli security services find out that a Palestinian is gay or trans, they will use that against them and blackmail them into becoming an informant for Israel. And if they refuse to, then they will out them to their community, even though it could put their life in danger. So these things are really connected on a visceral level. And that's why Palestinian queer groups like Al-Qaus, Aswat, and Palestinian Queers for Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions all work to fight both anti-queer oppression and racism and colonialism of the Israeli state at the same time. And here is Hanin Maiki, who's a Palestinian queer activist and the founder of Al-Qaus, talking about her reasons for rejecting the kind of pinkwashing arguments that the Israeli state makes, where Israel often argues that it's acting to protect Palestinian gays. And I've heard people claim that Palestinian gays find refuge in Israel. That's not really true. So unlike Russia, where local LGBT groups have advised against a boycott, Palestinian queer groups actually endorse the Palestinian call for boycott, divestment and sanctions on Israel. In 2005, Palestinian civil society groups launched the BDS campaign, and a part of this campaign has been queer BDS. BDS stands for boycott, divestment and sanctions, which is specifically about challenging pinkwashing. And the group Palestinian Queers for Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions is one of the groups that has been formed to work on queer BDS. So the strategy of BDS is to use non-violent tactics to force Israel to address its occupation and oppression of Palestinians in the occupied Palestinian territories, in Israel and in exile. And there are three really basic demands, which are the ones that Palestinian groups have agreed are the minimum basics that are needed for some kind of justice to be achieved and for some kind of peace to be possible. And here in Aotearoa, we've recently launched the Aotearoa BDS Network after a nationwide conference. Our thieves campaign is focusing on G4S, which is a private security company that provides prisons and checkpoints for Israel. So in that sense, I think it has a lot of overlap with local and global issues around incarceration and prison privatization. And we're inviting LGBT organisations to sign on to the letter that we are going to send Superfund to ask them to divest their shares in G4S. So if you want to learn more, you can come along to our campaign launch, which is in 3 weeks' time at Thistle Hall. This is going to be workshops and music and food and poetry. You can learn more about their campaign and how you can get involved. And also, I've brought a bunch of leaflets along today. So if anyone wants to do your own research, I've got a list of some useful books and also websites where you can learn more. And now I think Nadia is going to speak more specifically on, well, on feminist nationalism, I suppose.
Kia ora, everybody. My name is Nadia. I've lost my voice a little bit, so I'm going to try and keep this relatively short as well, because I feel like a lot of the points have kind of started to already be fleshed out, and what I really want to do is kind of just add to that a little bit. And I want to add to that from the perspective of a Palestinian who has spent quite a bit of time in Palestine and Israel, and also someone who's spent a lot of time living in the UK and New Zealand. And I'm really glad that I'm getting to have this conversation, because actually it's probably one of my least favourite things to talk about, is women in the Middle East, because so often what I feel is that as soon as that emerges, people feel this instant sort of like they're waiting for me to say the assumptions and the things that they already have. And when I say things that contradict those assumptions, they seem a little bit like thrown. But when I say things that play into those assumptions, they really, really seem to, oh yeah, yeah, I get that. Oh yeah, no, it must be terrible. It must be really, really hard for women over there. So I think that we all already have to acknowledge that we all already have ideas about this stuff. And I think even as a Palestinian, you know, I see them in myself. And it's sometimes just about unlearning and recognizing why things are framed the way they are, why we have the narrative that we have, and actually just picking that apart a little bit and saying, why is it that we're so familiar with the image of someone like Malala, you know, who's at the moment just hanging out with Obama? And it's like, on the one hand, we've got this woman, and you see her, and this young woman, who, you guys all know who I'm talking about, right?
Yeah.
Who, you know, we see taking the world stage. And it's not very often that you see, you know, a 16-year-old or 14-year-old, 15-year-old Pakistani woman talking about, you know, the right to education and that kind of a forum. But I think that with someone like Malala, it's important to remember that she serves a purpose, and that's why, you know, she has her own agency. But she's for people like Obama, for people like Gordon Brown, who voted for the war in Iraq and now saying, oh, you know, like, we really need to support women's rights in the Middle East, that for them she simply serves a purpose, because they're not going to bring up, you know, and I'm just going to brief trigger warning here, I'm not going to go too much into it, but a bit of a story of sexual abuse and rape, and but there was a young woman, same age as Malala, called Abia Qasim Hamza al-Janabi, who, you know, none of us know the name of. Like, I can actually put that out there. I didn't know her name until 3 days ago. And, what happened to her was that during the occupation of Iraq, five US soldiers actually gang raped her, then proceeded to murder her entire family and her and burn the house down. And I think the thing is that so often, when we're talking about culture, and we're talking about culture in reference to cultures of violence or cultures of violence against women, we're always talking about cultures of the Middle East. And one of my favourite speakers on this issue is Leila Abu-Laghad, and what she says is, I'm going to say something here, and that's that we don't talk about culture, because often these arguments are so unevenly distributed, and I think it's a really dangerous thing to say, to attribute these things to culture, because we don't attribute, you know, for example, the cultures. Well, she says, what if she was to pen something as a culture that promotes violence, she would say it was a culture of militarism, and a culture of militarism and you know, the occupation and invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan, or Israel through Palestine, is actually what we don't denote that to Protestant or Catholic or Christian or Judaism. We just call it politics, you know, and it's related to economics and it's related to all this stuff. So I think if we are talking about this stuff in the West, then we need to actually be asking, okay, there's this culture of militarism, and our question isn't how do we, you know, stop these awful cultures doing these things to these women, but how do we stop this culture of militarism that's actually stopping these women from moving, stopping these women from, you know, being able to organize and do everything that they need to do, really. And to round off that bit, because I think I could talk, you know, for a long time about a lot of the things that afflict women in the Middle East, and I could go on to talk about the occupation of Palestine, you know, for a long time. But I actually want to do something a bit different, which is I want to talk about some of the women that I know that, you know, fight these things in their own ways, and because that's the argument that I want to make, is that, you know, these things, they come about, they can't be imposed. Women themselves are organising and doing their thing in the Middle East very well, and have been doing so for a long time. So I want to talk about, first of all, I want to talk about my grandma, who is fucking awesome. And she, when she was like 14, grew up, and she had like 7 brothers, and she decided she wanted to smoke a pipe. And so she just like picked up a pipe and she was like, I'm smoking this pipe now because my brother smoked the pipe. And everyone in that culture was like, not sure whether you should be smoking the pipe. And she was like, I'm going to do it. And she does it. She does it to this day. She still smokes a pipe. I know that's a really small example, but to me, that's just one of many of the women that I know that do these things. I'm thinking about my auntie Selwa, who, you know, her husband, my uncle, has been a political prisoner for pretty much their entire married life, you know, merely for organizing, you know, merely for being someone who is politically active in the way that we are right now in this room. He, you know, he spent a long, long time in Israeli prisons. And right up at the front of every march, you have Selwa on the megaphone shouting at people and just absolutely, you know, just really, really demolishing all those arguments you hear about these women, because she just, to me, she represents everything that inspires me. And she, you know, she would not miss a march. And when my dad went to get married, they need sort of like a different signatories, and they need 2 male signatories. And she just actually just called the guy out, the judge out at the office, and just said, I'll sign it. And that's just, you know, I know so many women like that, that are doing that thing. And I think, you know, when you think about the things that affect these women, this stuff doesn't happen in a vacuum. When actually so many of the loss and so many of the hurt and so many of the things that happen to these women isn't about their family, you know, in the same way that we're made to think it is, you know, that these familial and like sort of patriarchal and the community is like really oppressing these women. It's actually, you know, it's actually the occupation, for example, in Palestine, which shot my stepmom's brother in front of her when she was 12 years old. You know, that's the most scarring experience of her life. You know, she went on to work in a university, own her own flat, and do her thing. But, you know, that's what's jarred her. You know, those experiences. Because also, when we're talking about women, I think, you know, Ian and Ali touched on this a little bit. We're always dehumanizing Palestinian men as like these sort of like backward, disgusting terrorist, you know, like sexist people. And I think about my dad, and I think about the fact that when my mum and dad divorced, my mum says all the time that when people hear she has an Arab last name and that she was married to a Palestinian, they always say, "Oh, that must have been hard." She goes, "No, it wasn't. He was a great dad and a great husband, but, you know, he just wasn't the person for me." But they already have this idea about, they already have this idea about what my dad is like. They've never even met him. They have no idea who he is. But they already have that idea that he is this person, this image that they have in their minds. So I think, like, a lot of the loss that afflicts women in the Middle East is actually seeing their sons, seeing their partners, seeing their fathers and their brothers, you know, imprisoned, because that is an absolute likelihood. You know, my dad doesn't have a single brother in Palestine that hasn't spent time in prison being tortured and whatnot. Or, you know, actually being killed, like my stepmom's brother, or, you know, just not being able to participate the way they want to participate and not being able to move the way they want to move. And the other thing, the last thing I want to say, is that I think it's interesting, like, how much these things kind of infiltrate the way we think and actually affect us here. And I really like what Ian said about, you know, thinking about the enemy, you know, that we have here. Because I found it really interesting. We had a friend, a journalist, come over from Gaza, a young blogger called Yusuf. And he was telling me about the group they run in Gaza, you know, where they live under siege and it's under Hamas rule. We're constantly hearing about how oppressed women in Gaza are. And when Yusuf came over here, he came up to the Palestine conference we had in Auckland, and I was whinging to him the whole time about the absolute lack of representation of women, and of Arab women, and of women of colour, and of men of colour that we had at our conference. And he was talking to me about the group that he is a part of, which is a group of youth bloggers, writers, activists. And actually, 80% of them are women. And, you know, they're the ones writing the articles. They're the ones moving and actually organising so much politically in the youth movements in Gaza. And, you know, me and Ali were just remarking how interesting we found it that, you know, we thought we'd come so much further. Yet in our own community, you know, we were struggling to get heard, where women in Gaza are, you know, having these groups where basically they set the agenda. So I think that's a really interesting point for reflection. And yeah, that's kind of where I want to end it. And I just want to say for question time that I'm really excited to hear, you know, the kind of questions that people have. Although, God forbid, if anybody asks me any questions about the headscarf, then, you know, like, it will be over. We can't have that. But it is a learning space, and I do, like, acknowledge that. And I want to say as well that, you know, like, I'm learning a lot of people here, and I really appreciate being able to come into this space. You know, I'm not a part of the queer community, but I really appreciate, I think, you know, tying these things together and just seeing the way that they do actually, you know, these structures of power actually often just totally abuse and use our struggles, you know, be it like as Palestinian women or as queers or as trans, you know, to actually legitimate the fucked up things they do. So that's kind of what I want to say, and I want to kind of welcome any korero that people want to have around this stuff and welcome a kind of like a hearty discussion on it. So, yeah, thank you, everybody.
I actually prepared a talk that was meant to be presented last night on the panel called Fighting Homophobia and Transphobia and Bigotry in Our Communities. But given the context of things that happened yesterday and dealing with racism and this white centrism in the queer community, I didn't have the energy to speak at that last night. And upon hearing stuff that everyone's been talking about in this panel, I've going to change the talk a little bit to be more relevant about home and nationalism, and actually my talk already was touching on that, but maybe more explicitly I'll talk about that today. So I'm also speaking as a member of Shakti Community Council, which is a feminist organisation to end family violence and gender-based violence in Asian, Middle Eastern, African communities in Aotearoa. And I'm also speaking as a member of the youth unit, but not everything I say will reflect the views of everyone in that organisation. And I also want to just give a disclaimer that the way I present this talk may not be very coherent, but that's also deliberate, because I don't think my sexuality, culture, community or gender is very coherent, so I don't think my speech should be expected to be either, and I think that's okay. So I kind of took down notes while everyone else was speaking, and I thought it would be good to talk about cultural imperialism as another form of imperialism that happens in queer communities in Aotearoa, in terms of cultural domination, and it's not just a process but a condition that we live in, particularly as people of colour or Indigenous people, that kind of cultural imperialism is quite visible. And, you know, we use categories from Western sexology, homosexual, heterosexual, bisexual, and those categories seem to be applied universally. And I guess the term queer and trans is also another manifestation of that. And I think that's a really important part to acknowledge in terms of colonization. Initially, I was going to talk a bit about some of my experiences kind of coming out to my parents, and also it's something that I find quite hard to talk about in predominantly Pākehā queer scenes because of the assumptions that it may play into about the homophobia that happens in Chinese communities particularly. But I think I will, because it also illustrates the complexity of being a migrant on colonized land and the kind of colonization of consciousness that happens through religion, and whether that kind of framework of justifying homophobia would still be there if your conversion to Christianity didn't happen. So I think for queer and trans people from Asian, Middle East and African backgrounds, not all our cultures are actually homophobic or transphobic necessarily, as there is a lot of diversity in those communities within each culture and also between them. But I've kind of drawn a lot of strength from connecting with other people from those backgrounds and from people of colour in general, who've supported each other through stuff, because white queers will never really understand what we go through. And for many of us, coming out isn't always an option or a risk we're willing to take, because the potential of cutting ties with our families is a lot harder. So I can only really talk about my experiences about this. And I had thought about it for a long time before telling my parents that I had a girlfriend, and that, you know, the kind of back and forth thoughts about, oh shit, is this going to end in family violence or disownment? But at the end of the day, when I did do that, that didn't happen, although they were convinced that it's a sin and a mental illness. And they kept being really confused because they thought there was no homosexual gene in our family. So how could this happen? And they're quite popular homophobic explanations, and they also blame Shakti for it, because working there you only see the bad side of heterosexual relationships mainly. And I just think it's something that they didn't really understand, and also our experience as migrants in Auckland with facing social exclusion and racism as the norm exacerbated that homophobia, because moving to Aotearoa, they were generally quite socially isolated. And while there were a few families from our hometown, but them not being able to speak English made it really hard to find a community that was supportive. So when I was 8 or 9, my mum converted to Christianity and kind of made everyone else in the family convert to Christianity, because there were Chinese-speaking churches where, you know, the ideals of heterosexual marriage as the way God intended things actually made it really hard for my parents to not be homophobic. And with sermons advocating against the marriage equality bill, and then kind of like asking me if I wanted to sign the petition, I was like, oh god, this is before I came out to them. But then I was just like, I don't support marriage in general, so. But when that bill passed, you know, I kind of used humour as a way of like dealing with this. So, and I told my mum that like I could maybe finally fulfil her wish and get married to my girlfriend. And she just looked at me and was like, don't disgust me. And I laughed because it's actually a joke. I mean, I'm never going to get married. That's actually quite disgusting. But in migrant communities where it's so small and most people know each other, rumours and gossip can be really alienating, and there is a lot more at stake for our families in Western racist and homophobic contexts because of this. And that colonisation of consciousness through religion, because of migration and social hostility and exclusion from the dominant culture, makes it harder for my family, not just for me, if I'm out. And as many of the other panelists have already talked about, there's a common perception that Asian cultures are more conservative and homophobic or transphobic, sexist and violent, which, you know, then implies that white people from Western Europe or Anglophonic colonial settler societies are more progressive when it comes to gender relations, sexuality and sexual identity. It's racist and can really exacerbate homophobia and transphobia in our communities. And for white people to be exploiting these tensions and highlighting that homophobia and transphobia or misogyny or whatever in our community exacerbates racism. So given the kind of interconnection and entanglement of homophobia and racism and transphobia, I think we really need to think about queer liberation in a way that takes into account all those intersectionalities. So I think the dominant ideal of queer liberation is, you know, to be, is really Pākehā way of thinking about liberation. And I think queer liberation can look quite differently and requires different strategies depending on the different communities that we come from or associate with. And I don't think it's okay to universalise or centre Pākehā, queer and trans subjectivities for projects of queer liberation, especially on colonised land. Because in that sense, to be liberated often means to assimilate, and that just encourages those Orientalist discourses and assumptions of Western civilizational and moral superiority. And I don't know if how many people here watch the speeches in Parliament about gay marriage. The amount of times people said New Zealander as you know, we New Zealanders should not tolerate this, and kind of using nationalist language to further queer liberation, which then excludes particular minority groups in the country. And I'd actually like to hear from other people who are people of colour identify as Indigenous about this topic, especially around cultural imperialism and racism in our communities. Because I think that's really important to have discussions about this, and if I have all the answers, can I open it up for discussion?
Yeah, I reckon, like you said, it's quite hard to, talk about the stuff in like spaces that are quite white spaces. so it's kind of annoying. So I don't really have anything to say.
Yeah.
I do have lots to say, but anyway.
Yeah.
But I want to listen to that. Thank you.
Yeah. I think I really want to acknowledge that. That all my friends and, you know, elders who are trans or queer people of colour here and internationally in our homelands or in diasporic colonised lands have been really important in feeling like, you know, I can exist and I should exist. And that these, like, transnational connections, the visibility and articulation of migrant and refugee experiences of homophobia and transphobia, despite the risks and dangers involved, and those fighting misogyny, homophobia and transphobia in the communities, especially in like white dominated and queer and feminist spaces, they're the people that really inspire me, and I think I wouldn't really be able to speak if that kind of work hadn't already been done before me.
I identify as a New Zealander. My father's Kiwi and my mother's Chinese white. And when you said that Asian societies plus others can possibly be conservative, like I really did identify with that. And it was something I guess I believed, and it just sort of, I mean, from my mother, I guess, sort of picking up on the subconscious signals from the family, and that sort of thing, and common belief. But at the end of the day, but just while you were saying that, when I was actually thinking about it, I was like, well, actually, at the end of the day, me coming out to my parents, my father was as conservative as my mother, and perhaps ultimately, perhaps ultimately more conservative, or at least more rigid in his views when my mother was perhaps more rigid. Despite her saying at one point, you know, Chinese culture is very conservative, you know. And so, yeah, she bought into that, and I bought into it up to a point, but perhaps through cultural experiences. So, yeah, it's
I think it's really easy to internalise those ideas.
Yeah. And my mother had, obviously.
Yeah.
They were very good. Yeah.
I'd like to point out that thinking about, for example, when you said Asian cultures are seen as more conservative, even putting the idea of being conservative onto Asian cultures is a form of cultural colonialism.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to point that out. Like, not as a critique or anything. Culture and think about these relationships.
Yeah, I think even like the category of Asian is like a really broad and problematic one that was invented by Europe.
And one part of the short is we know about the heterogeny of our own culture. We know that there isn't a single part of our culture. There's many parts of it. It's a very contradictory thing. There is a tendency sometimes to see the other as very homogenous and all the same, and in that completely different from what we experience. But there are possibly just as many contradictions and differences and complexities
any court.
Yeah, that's true. I think the issue is that when there are those tensions in othered cultures, it becomes a source of, like, often the kind of like feminists in like Asian cultures are ignored or like not seen as existing, and the kind of dominant cultures are misogynistic and like, yeah, I think those tensions get exploited for racist agendas.
I'd like to give a comment, but Lizzie, thank you for sharing your story with people, because I always say quite a lot to put out there, so thank you for that. I guess my comment is, I mean, I was involved with the American Equality Campaign, and I made all the submissions, but I guess one of the things, picking up on perhaps one of the things that you said was, I mean, one of the things that struck me most about the American Equality Campaign and the opposition that came to the bill was just, I personally felt it was really regrettable and unfortunate that the most visible opposition to the bill was from survivors who were protesting, and also Korean church members who were protesting. Those, to me, seem the most visible people growing up, as well as probably Korean and so on. And I just thought it was really unfortunate that was the case. I do think that there is some truth to the view that some of the Chinese are more conservative with sexuality. And so, you know, one of those good things I have to do is to kind of turn my back on my American Equality Campaign, even though there's just other things I'm fine, but that was quite difficult, and he didn't react very well to it. But I just thought the whole race issue is just, it's very regrettable. That's my comment.
And I think one thing with that was, you know, one of the comments that was made around that time was that people who are opposed to this should go back home. And, like, did that include Colin Craig? Kind of like, yes.
But also you saw from the Labour Party, like, as problematic, and anyone knows, I'm not the biggest fan of Labour Party itself, but you saw that within that dynamic of that, like, conservative PI union members are opposed to Grant Robinson because he's gay. And it's like, you know, if you actually look at all the research and stuff that's coming out, and that's what was interesting, is that in terms of the research that's coming out, is that, you know, specific PI communities are no more homophobic than the Pākehā communities. But it's, again, this trope, and it's like, sweet, if you go down to a meeting of 3,000 people, you're going to find 10 conservative people in there that you can get a soundbite from, and it presents the PI community and stuff. And so I think it's multifaceted and quite deep and complex in that sense, and I think it's a real challenge and a real important thing to actually fight those stereotypes that are quite easy to fall back on.
Yeah, I think when white people talk, they're not seen as representing their community, but it's like.
And besides, like, you could hardly have said that 30 years ago when white culture was just as conservative as any other culture on this question. And I don't think it is. Cultures move very quickly.
The thing is, too, I think that it would never be called, it would never be named as white culture being against marriage equality. It would be people against marriage equality. That's how it would be framed to most people, right? It would be, yeah.
People with religious or political views, not people with, like, a culture kind of.
People with white views, yeah.
And I can echo what you said about, like, your family going to, like, a Christian church and then becoming homophobic. That's kind of like the story of lots of colonized places, most non-white cultures wouldn't be homophobic if they weren't colonized. So it's kind of like any bits of homophobia and transphobia and stuff is kind of And even just like the idea that there's like two sexes and two genders and blah blah blah, you know, that's like white people shit. that's white people bullshit. And it's kind of like, so anything that is coming from our, you know, from our people, it's as a result of colonization, you know, as a direct result of colonization. It's not really our cultures, it's, you know, it's colonial shit.
So it's still blamed on us.
Do you think that it's always colonial? Like, I mean, obviously, like, there's lots of cultures that weren't heteronormative or gender normative, but is Europe the only place in the world that had that and been exported to the rest of the world?
Not really, no. I guess I just know that this culture, my culture wasn't like that.
Yeah.
I
know.
Certainly, I'd say, even if, you know, even if that's not precisely the case, the gender and sexuality system that is currently dominant is the one that Europe exported globally, I'd say. But,
Oh, I guess I just wanted to bring up the fact that someone mentioned before that it was a really white space, which it totally is, and I was just wondering, I don't know who would be the right person to even answer this question, but... would it be appropriate for the last half hour of this to be a discussion among people of colour, and should us whiteys leave and give some space? But I don't know who is the best person to answer that, or even if anyone would want to put themselves out there to answer it, so I just thought it was worth thinking about.
Yes. There's also a free room, so, I mean, we could, like, yeah, we could have two discussions if we wanted, but it depends what people think.
I think maybe what's important is that if people are like, oh yeah, hey, white people will pass off, then it will.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, I think that homophobia stuff is something that can be exported and colonized, but also the strategies of queer liberation can also be exported from, you know, from the US or whatever into other places, and that also needs to be questioned, as, you know, like this panel has kind of done.
I think I really appreciate that you shared that experience of coming out as well, and like you said, you know, you often feel that feeling of not wanting to play into people's assumptions, and that's kind of something I was talking about. And I think that when someone does that in a room, you need to be like, it's like there's a lot of trust involved in that, instead of saying, I'm going to tell you something that might play into your assumptions right now, but I'm going to acknowledge that you're going to see the complexities in that. Because I think it's really good if we can have that conversation and say, look, it is like this, and it was like this for me, and this might play into this and this assumption, but I want to flesh out a broader argument. So like, I really appreciate that you did say that, because, you know, I know in my conversations with some of my friends, you know, we sort of say that we don't talk about some of the more sexist elements of things that happen within our family, within certain groups of people, because we know that that immediately will be all well here. So I think just to acknowledge that you did share that, I think is something we should do in this room, just kind of, you know, because it does take a lot of trust to sort of say, I'm giving you this information, and, you know, do not misuse it, like, do not misconstrue what I'm saying, because I've been in situations with, you know, Zionists and ex-Israeli soldiers, actually, who've been quite liberal, and who I've had, like, long conversations with, and, you know, quite uncomfortable. These are people who, you know, have been occupying, quite literally, probably, could have, you know, thrown tear gas canisters at my family, or, you know, and so we're talking, and then, you know, somehow I fell into the trap of talking about some of my experiences of sexism in the Middle East, which is ridiculous. And he just goes, yeah, see, you know, ultimately, this is the bottom line, isn't it? This is the bottom line for us. You know, that's why you'll never want that, and that's why ultimately, like, we need to protect Israel, and you see why I do the work that I do. And that was it for him, you know, like, that was a sealed deal. So I just want to acknowledge that it does take a lot of trust to say those things.